Think of all the books that have influenced who you are. Now, let's advance the conversation. In this podcast, I'll dig into topics that affect how you see the world by talking with authors who write about them. This is Capradio Reads. I'm Donna Epidoni. Today, you'll hear a conversation with author Tommy Orange in front of an audience of book lovers. Tommy Orange earned accolades for his compelling writing in There, There. The book is about people navigating life in Oakland, California through their indigenous heritage. It's so good that publishers fought over the right to print it, yet he's modest about that success. He told Insight's Beth Ruyak why his book resonates with readers.
I hate that the first place my mind goes around this question is Trump. But it's totally related, because he's made people make the decision about what do they value and who do they side with and what do they want to do about it. And the book sold right after Standing Rock was a big thing. Mm-hmm. Native people aren't in national attention very often. But it's always when we have been in a major way, it's always been followed by a boom in interest ever since the first Native American literary renaissance, in which we took over Alcatraz and Marlon Brando had Sashi and Little Feather not accept the Academy Award.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was the first boom. And then there was a lot of attention, then not that much, and then in the 90s, Dances with Wolves won a lot of awards, and that had the same effect, and that, so Standing Rock and Trump, like, these are factors that I can't help but think of. Of course, I'm not just going to be like the merit of my work. It's not the case. A lot of amazing books come out every year. A lot are missed, a lot are found later. So I think our times, the political times, and having people want to listen more to marginal voices, and I think that's the main thing. I mean, I have a lot of other weird side theories I'm not going to get into, but...
Why not? Give me one.
Well, it's different for each country, too, because it's been translated into like 24 different languages, and I was just in Germany, and they have kind of their own weird interest in Native people, and it's doing well there. And they had a guy named Karl May, who's a novelist, who had never been to America and never met a Native person, and he sold like 40 million books. And so it was like a reverse of Tonto and Lone Ranger. It was Winnetou, and I don't know what the sidekick was, but he was a white cowboy. The main guy was Winnetou, who's a Native guy, out of Karl May's imagination. And everyone loved Native people because of growing up reading these stories. So the theory for German people is that's related to this very specific thing.
You said something about a renaissance, and there are people calling you the new Native Renaissance. I know you've heard that before. How does that play to you? What does that mean?
I don't love it, because the Renaissance has always meant like a resurgence in interest in Native people and matters, and then it's like a trend that dies off, and I would rather have a sustainable interest in what is our country's relationship to the people who were here before, and what is our national identity, and how does it relate to how we ended up a nation. That should be a lasting way that we reimagine who we are as Americans, our relationship to the people who were here, and how we acquired the land, and all that we did should be a lasting formation of the American identity, and not some like romanticized thing that we can think of sometimes when we're like, oh, what are they doing again? And then go back to thinking that we don't exist anymore, which has been the case for a long time.
But something's happening with this. The United States actually wasn't the first country to pick up and translate this book, was it?
No, there was a Danish-Swedish deal.
first.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
My agents like got spies all over the world. They call them that. It's like a slang literary term. But she has all these sub-agents kind of looking out for things going on. And so my book had some kind of whatever the spies are interested in. And yeah, like a month before it sold in the U.S., it sold to a sister company, Danish-Swedish companies.
So how do you say the title of your book?
They're There.
I wondered if it would sound the Gertrude Stein way or the Radiohead way or just the way we calm each other. They're There.
I don't know how I would say it if it was supposed to be like, this is how I say it.
Can you say it the Radiohead way?
No. I mean, he doesn't sing it in the song. He only has one there. Just because you feel it doesn't mean it's there. I don't know why he has the two theirs.
I think to make that clear, let's go to that reference, because it's pretty early on in the book, page 29, I think, that there's a reference to the song by Radiohead with There, There. And I think that plays for you literally and figuratively, doesn't it?
Getting to those lyrics and referencing Tom York in the book was a serendipitous thing that I never intended to do. I found the Gertrude Stein quote and loved when I landed on There, There as a title so much that I Googled it and found this Radiohead song that I knew, but I knew it as track 09 because I pirated the album Hail to the Thief that it was on. And so I did love that song already, but it was track 09. And I didn't know the lyrics because who knows what Tom York is ever singing about. And so when I saw the lyrics, they were so true to the book. I felt like a kind of blessing from Tom York. Because I love Radiohead, and I never would have thought, just because I love something doesn't mean it belongs in the book, I never would have thought Radiohead would have entered the book, but because it felt so strong a connection, I sort of forced it in.
Can you roughly give a percentage of how much is true or somewhat autobiographical and how much is purely fictionalized? And I say that right there because I think it's Tony Lone Man who listens to MF Doom in his headset. And it's a true band. I didn't know them. I had to Google them. But it must have been a band you listened to. And I thought, this book is peppered with little details all the way through that are really you. And maybe you only know all of them. So at least give me a percentage.
I love MF Doom. He's a rapper. And his themes, again, it's like, I wasn't just trying to throw him in because I love him. The character who loves him thinks of his face as a mask and also thinks of himself as a villain in a way, and he is a villain in a way. He's sort of somewhere between anti-hero and supra-villain, the way it ends up. But Doom himself was in a band called KMD in the 90s, and his brother was in the band, and his brother died, and they were in contract with a record label. And the record label cut them once his brother died, very coldly. And so he left the scene for a long time and came back in this villain persona and wore a mask. And these were elements that I thought were just beautifully entangled with Tony's story and why he might, even though Tony may not know this information, why he might identify with Doom as a rapper and with this villain identity.
So there are parts of your book that stand out as a moment that you reached deeper inside yourself. And it's funny you just said that, because I tend to flag my book with places where I feel a little bit of closeness to an author. And one of my flags says, Tony Mask. So if you wouldn't mind, just doing a little bit. It's a small paragraph, but sure. It speaks exactly to what you were saying.
Tony realizes he can open his eyes again, but he keeps them closed. He knows he's full of holes. He can feel each one of those bullets trying to pull him down. He watches himself go up, out of himself. Then he watches himself from above, looks at his body, and remembers that it was never actually really him. He was never Tony, just like he was never the Drome. Both were masks.
So did Tony emerge as the first character because the story went that way? Or were you in any way trying to deal right away at the beginning of the book with a stereotype that happens and the issue of alcohol and alcoholism?
Well, I never work from the outside in the sense that I want to have a character that deals with an issue. So let's see what happens. I much more go to write, especially in the first year of writing, and a voice that comes out. Like I was working full time. I just became a father, and I would write before I went to work. I'd wake up at like 5 a.m. and write for a couple hours, and then I'd write when my son went to sleep. And so whatever came during that time, I sometimes would give myself some kind of prompt or basic detail to move from, or setting, and other times it would just go, and these were just characters that came. So whatever issues in the native world that end up coming up, I never came to the characters with, like, you're going to deal with these issues for me because I want to bring them up. The book ends up being political because it sort of has to be, but I was much more writing from a place of where I knew fiction could live. That has to do with what the internal lives of people are like and what ends up happening when our lives are forced together.
Did the concept of the book come to you in sort of a moment, sort of an idea, and then unfolded from there?
It did. It was maybe a couple weeks after I found out I was going to be a father, and we were, if we're driving to L.A., to see this very crazy rapper pianist named Chili Gonzalez at the Largo at the Coronet. It's a venue in LA. I started thinking about what a novel might look like, and we were driving down, and as a lot of great ideas can come from not thinking, this sort of like popped into my head, this idea of having all these lives converge at a powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. And I just became convinced by that premise. And powwows are such a great place for an urban Indian story to be told, because they're contemporary and traditional feeling, and they're intertribal. And there's just there's a lot of resonance for the urban Indian to be told in that context, and then for it to be Oakland and Oakland Coliseum. I'd also known that I wanted to write a novel about Oakland, because there's not that much out there.
Tommy, if you don't know, was raised in Oakland and worked for a while at a used bookstore. Had you ever been to a powwow before? Had that been part of your life and your experience? I'll say that your father has Native heritage. Your mom was white. So it wouldn't be out of the realm to think that maybe your family had gone to a powwow.
My dad is full-blood Cheyenne from Oklahoma. Grew up in a rural town, small town, and he didn't grow up going to powwows, so he didn't really raise us going. We went to a few in my childhood, and one memorable one when I was 18, I don't know why he took us randomly, to one in Berkeley at a gymnasium. Well, I guess this is why, because the kid I grew up with, we only grew up with one other Indian family in Oakland, and they were the Browns. And us being the Oranges, I knew there was some connection to last name in Indian families, but I knew there had to be something else to it, and he never had a good explanation as to why we were the Oranges.
That was going to be one of my questions. Where did that last name come from?
It's a Cheyenne name, but there's a lot of mysteries to last names when it comes to colonization and black people and tribal people who don't have a history of last names and surnames and patriarchy embedded in the same way into their culture. It's a sordid history, and there's a lot of different reasons why last names would end up kind of weird. And so I don't know what ours is. At one point in kindergarten, my mom has orange hair, and we had an orange van at the time. We would get dropped off two blocks from school because my sisters were mortified by the idea of being the oranges and being... And I didn't care. I mean, I was in kindergarten.
You didn't care. You were little.
I wasn't.
Yeah. Do you have a native name?
Yeah. My dad gave us all Cheyenne names. So mine translates as birds sing in the morning. A not very good Cheyenne version of that because we didn't grow up speaking my language is Vigas Melnistos. You know, he just woke up one morning very early and was inspired to name me that.
Is that part of the coincidence of talking about the birds singing at both the beginning and the ending of the book, or was that intentional?
Well, the ending I wrote somewhere in the middle where I knew, like, this is the ending. Mm. And when it came out like that, I just felt like this was the completion of something. I don't know if there's birds at the beginning, is there?
There's a poem. There's just a short verse at the beginning. I'm sorry,
I hope not. I didn't write a poem.
You know what? This is so funny. It's the Bertolt Brecht verse.
Yes.
And after I read the book all the way through, I just transposed in my brain that it was birds that were singing. But he says, will there be singing? Mm-hmm. And so I made that connection.
I never even put together that the singing begins and ends it. That's great.
Well, in my mind, and there were birds at the start. I don't know what to say about that. So Margaret Atwood called this an astonishing literary debut. And everyone...
On Twitter. She made sure that we could only say that she said that on Twitter. And it says it on the book, if you'll notice.
On Twitter. Have you corresponded with her? Have you met her?
Mm-mm.
No. Had you ever gone to see an author or a reading? Was that part of your love
Mm-mm.
of book? No.
It usually took me like four books until I was like, wait, who is this? And like I would look on the back. Like I don't, in terms of when I love a book, like it's like the book and the words and the language and getting involved in the world. And the persona of the author never, I didn't have anything against them. It's just, it never occurred to me, be like, who's writing this? Until like, I'm like way deep into like I said, like four books in, I'm like, okay, who is this person? And then I'll like Google them, like, oh, okay. And then that's the end of the interest. I never am like, I want to see them.
So here you are.
Not to say this is a bad thing. It's like, this is at a book event. I'm like, who are these people that want to see the author? It's just not something that like occurred to me that it was even a thing to do. I didn't even know that you could look up like, how do I see an author? Because I've never been part of a literary world. I came to reading on my own. So the idea of meeting an author, it just didn't even occur to me.
What does that mean? I came to reading on my own.
Oh, so I didn't go to school for it. I didn't even read really until after college. And I got my undergrad in sound engineering, and I was a musician, and
an athlete.
I was an athlete before that. Dreams of being a professional roller hockey player dominated my teenagedom. There was a professional team out of Oakland at the Oakland Coliseum called the Oakland Skates.
And you were ranked, or you were?
I was sponsored by a company, and had a favorite player named Roman Hubilev. And
so, being an author was never in the realm.
No, I mean, I didn't even have a single conversation about going to college in my teenage years, and nobody was a reader in my family.
How was this when this book is released and and someone said to you, well, you're going to go out on book tour now, and you're going to go do readings, and people are going to talk to you, and you're going to sign books, and this was all brand new?
Well, at first I was like, well, they gave me a decent amount of money, and that was really cool. at first I was like, sure, like, I want to please the publisher and sell more books. And then about halfway through the book tour, doing like a lot of public speaking after doing zero public speaking, I felt like I was going to die. Because it was like, this is not what I signed up for. Mm. Like, I write in private so people can read in private, and the public part should never come into play if you do it right, I thought. So eventually I got used to it.
But people were coming at you with personal questions and a lot of interest in you as much as the book, an intense interest in you. So how was that? And how did you field the times when maybe it was uncomfortable or personal? Or I've seen interviews where people have gotten a little bit aggressive too, thinking you have all the answers and explanations now for a lot of this history and a lot of where we should be in it today in this era.
I don't know. A lot of stuff that's like enrages people. I have this thing in my brain where like I turn everything into sadness. So like people will do stuff and ask offensive questions, and like I will respond however I'll respond, but like in the end I just get so sad about it. And I think I spent a long time really panicked about doing and having anxiety around these events and getting really sad about the state of things. And more recently I've entered this state of calm, tranquil acceptance of everything. It's certainly not enlightenment. It's just like out of the darkness into like, oh, this is fine. And so it's definitely been hard. And, you know, book tour can sound glamorous to authors and success even. I get to write for a living now. Like, that's an amazing thing. And totally worth all of the hardship. But it's definitely not been uncomplicated and trying in a lot of ways that I never would have thought of. So when people are asking me the beginning, like, will you do all this stuff? I'm like, I said yes to everything. And I'm just now getting to a place where I'm either saying no or I'm actually canceling things because it's too much. I'll burn out.
I heard in an interview that you said that it is difficult to talk to people who read your book and feel too sad or feel guilty. And then you don't really like those conversations. Will you tell me more about that? And how often does that happen?
The book is sad. And I included sadness purposefully because sometimes sadness is too sad to talk about, or like, there's no way to talk about it without people sort of getting annoyed at you, or it's just something that can't hold a solid place in our emotional conversations without being felt dismissed or like, what's wrong with you? Like, we all want to be happy, successful, busy people, and that's like the highest goal in American society. And it's like, there's no time to like, be a little bit sad and like, anyway, so the book is sad. But the people that I get upset about calling the book sad is this is the only thing they have to say about it, which feels totally dismissive of what a lot of the other stuff that is in the book. So they'll say things like, this is like direct quote from audience Q&A. I love the book, but it's just so sad. That's the whole thing. It's not a question. It's supposed to be a question. This is Q&A. But it's not. It doesn't take the formula of a question.
Nobody here would do that, just so you know.
So it's okay that it's sad, but this type of sentiment only comes from non-native people, and native people tend to be exuberant about the book and to feel like what they're reading in it, they know the sadness, and that's not what you come away with. And so it's much more of a reflection of the person making that comment than it is about the book or about the world and the context of which certain people's lives can seem sad. If yours is really great and you've had a privileged one that has not had pain, people can have happy lives who have a lot of pain. And a story you read about somebody with a lot of pain, they'll never call their story sad because it's not. They've found ways to find joy within that pain. So you calling it sad is sort of breaking down all of the structures they've built to make life worth living and joyous, even amidst sadness. You saying it's sad is breaking down all of the resilient structures they've built to make life continue to be worth living, even though there's a lot up against them.
What is this book for Native people? What are you hearing back?
Well, it's just like a modern depiction is hungry for there being no contemporary modern depictions that get popular attention, I think, is a combination of those things. Because there are a lot of people doing modern cool stuff in the Native world, but the attention doesn't happen. So my book's gotten a lot of attention, and that means there can be a shift in the way people think about Native people, and it can stop being so static and so historical and so monolithic, and it can have a range, because the book has a range of proximities to Native identity, and it's definitively contemporary, and that's just not something we've been allowed in the popular consensus and the way people think of Native people. And we're not so worried about what people think of Native people, except that we've been defined by the outside world so much, and this affects policies, and this affects the way we live our lives. So we have to be at least paying attention to what the world thinks of us. We have to.
The book has a lot of power, and if you would read this passage, this is from the prologue, which is a whole setting of power in and of itself. I think your use of the prologue is something that, for you personally as a writer, is an important part of structure, but what you were able to do with this, would you say something about, and then read this segment?
Well, I knew I wanted to write a prologue before I knew what I wanted it to be about. And then because prologues can break all the rules of whatever world you set up once you start the world of the novel. Prologues can be anything. And this is why I knew I wanted to write one, because I've always loved prologues in novels, specifically prologues in novels and what they can do. And so once I realized I wanted to write about sort of like an urban native contextual manifesto of like, what does it mean and where does it come from? Because it feels so absent in literature. It brought me through history and my own personal hearing of my dad's stories, and then eventually this Indian head theme and this finding on the internet of a telling of this rolling head, this Cheyenne story, this traditional old Cheyenne story that's very strange. My grandpa, who I never met, I found it on the internet. It's his telling of it that I incorporated into the prologue.
Really?
But this is the part that you asked me to read. When they first came for us with their bullets, we didn't stop moving, even though the bullets moved twice as fast as the sound of our screams. And even when their heat and speed broke our skin, shattered our bones, skulls pierced our hearts, we kept on. Even when we saw the bullets send our bodies flailing through the air like flags, like the many flags and buildings that went up in place of everything we knew this land to be before. The bullets were premonitions, ghosts from dreams of a hard, fast future. The bullets moved on after moving through us, became the promise of what was to come, the speed and the killing, the hard, fast lines of borders and buildings. They took everything and ground it down to dust as fine as gunpowder. They fired their guns into the air in victory, and strays flew out, into the nothingness of histories written wrong and meant to be forgotten. Stray bullets and consequences are landing on our unsuspecting bodies even now.
How young is too young to learn and read this? Is this book now in high schools, or have you heard from high school teachers yet?
I went to a high school in Wisconsin, and this teacher had sort of pushed through some grant to get the money for the book, and she made it happen for her high school. And I've heard of other similar stories, so it's definitely happening in high schools. And that same teacher, I went, it was my first high school event, and I'm so scared of high schoolers. The first thing I want to say when I get offered by my lecture agent, like, this high school wants you to come, I'm like, no, no.
Why?
The high schoolers are scary.
It wasn't so long ago for you.
It was like 20 years ago. No, but I always dread them, and then they're like the best events. And because I think when I go there, they're going to think I'm a high schooler, and it's going to be the same high school experience I had, and I'm going to become depressed again. Won't know my combination, my lock, which is where my book will be that I have to read in front of them. So a kid, a native kid from a visit to a Wisconsin high school, didn't speak up and wanted to because he felt just too shy or whatever. She sent a note from him in an email saying that he never would have thought, he would never even would have thought that he would see himself on the page of stuff to read in school. And he said it changed him as a reader, and that he'll never be the same kind of student again because he was able to find himself in the books. And that was, you know, that was an amazing moment for me. And so I keep doing high school things because of that, but it's scary every time.
I happen to think finding spider legs in a lump on your leg is scary. That's just not fiction, is it?
No.
This is a description in the book that one of the characters, two of the characters, and so three characters, right? And this part is a real story?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
It wasn't that scary or painful. Yeah, so it happened.
You don't have to tell the long version.
There were two legs that I pulled out and scoured the internet like the character.
Like where?
Orville
Can you
does.
Show me? Where were
There's
they?
There's still a bump right here. There still could be. It's probably scar tissue. So scoured the internet, and there's nothing anywhere that I could find. And I recently did another search and still couldn't find anything. My wife at first was like, it's an ingrown hair. And I'm like, ah, oh, so gross. But we kept looking at them. And they were long, and there's a bend in the leg, and it's like thicker on the end, thinner. It's not hair. Hair doesn't have bends.
So you talked about this at length.
Yeah.
And
so
with your friends.
There was a couple weeks where we were researching and sort of sharing with friends, like, isn't this crazy? But then eventually after I thought I would find something and didn't, I was like, this must be an Indian thing. And so I called my dad. And he was like, has this happened to anybody? And he said, it sounds to me like he got witched. And I was like, okay. Well, what do I do? And he just said, I'll pray for you. And that was it. He got a weird thing that happened to him in his medicine box. He had a doll put in there. And after it happened to him, a couple of bad things happened. And he knew exactly what to do. He put the thing between a wedge and a certain tree facing a certain direction. So I was a little mad about him having an easy solution to his problem and not one for me. So that happened, and it was crazy. And my dad didn't have a solution, and there was already a spider theme in the book. So I was like, well, this belongs in the book then, because I don't know what else to do with it.
What was your parents' reaction to the book? What'd your dad say, your mom say?
They're both super proud, and my mom's read it twice, and my dad gave me an underhanded compliment. He said, "I'm surprised at how much insight's in there." What did he think of me?
Are they written into any of the characters? I know there's a very vivid situation at your home that plays out with the angel dust overdose, but that was actually from a scenario that was real and pivotal in your family.
Yeah, so that's another autobiographical. Speaking of percentages, it's hard for me to, like, I couldn't say percentages across the book, but like the Thomas Frank chapter is like high percentage autobiographical.
That's why so many people say, of all the characters, Thomas Frank is the character most like you.
A lot of people say Dean Oxendine.
I was going to say, I think Dean Oxendine, and there are some parallel experiences there too.
Yeah, but it's less percentage-wise if we're going to talk and speak in those terms.
I'm really happy you returned to the percentage question, because I would have gone back to it, but the fact that you did says to me that you're listening and you're smart and you're courteous, and so let's carry on.
So, yeah, so I grew up evangelical Christian. My parents met in a Native American church ceremony in the 70s at a Peyote commune in northern New Mexico, and fell in love, moved to Oklahoma. And there, my dad was not doing so well at the time. A lot of drinking, and televangelism was making big leaps, we could say, in its popularity. And, you know, Christianity and Native people have such a mixed history. So there's a lot of people that loved Jesus on reservations and in different Native communities. So my mom had seen my great-grandma Laura get healed of arthritis by putting her hand on the TV. And not that long after, my mom was saved in front of the TV. I don't know which televangelist it was, but my dad was sort of not doing well. She had been, you know, treated not great by my dad's relatives, who hated that he brought a white woman home who was a hippie, and, you know. Eventually won the hearts of everyone, and they became very close, and still people, when my mom goes back there, still close. But she became evangelical Christian and brought that to Oakland. And raised us that way, even though my dad was still involved in Native American church and leading a lot of ceremonies as a roadman in Northern California. I'd be gone a lot of weekends to do that. And then Christian congregation and the Bible groups that would come would call what my dad was doing demonic. And this was sort of, and I thought the world was going to end. I never thought I'd be an adult. This was like my childhood. Because this is what they tell you. They sort of threaten you with, like, believe in Jesus in your heart, or you're going to go to hell forever and be suffering for eternity. So it's like the worst threat. It's so, like, shallow and empty feeling now. But at the time, when I'm a kid, I'm like, oh, I don't want to hurt forever. So I really need to consider this Jesus thing. Because that sounds like the absolute worst thing possible.
Has anyone ever told you that when you say that, you stare out at everybody as if you're one of those TV evangelists? Like, otherwise you're kind of relaxed, and then all of a sudden you lock in and you stare. You just did it.
That's how serious it feels when you're a kid. And you're like, well, then I'm hearing my mom speak in tongues, and my sister getting slain in the spirit and rolling around on the ground laughing like she's in heaven, heard later. And so everything feels very real and possible. Cut to, I'm 11. My sister becomes very interested in doing PCP. And she comes home and she has this very low demonic, as you would hear in movies, voice. It's not her voice. I can hear it. and she's having an argument with my dad about which God he believes in. And this sounds crazy, right? And I'm 11, just like, I don't, this all feels also very real. And this is what they're talking about, like demons and, you know. And then she, like, my mom calls her Christian friends over and they do like a prayer circle and give her milk for some reason that's supposed to help with PCP, like spicy food. And she foams at the mouth and comes out of it. And, you know, this was just like a very crazy moment for me and could have maybe like persuaded me to become the full-blown Christian evangelical believer my mom wanted me to be. But instead I fell in love with roller hockey.
Do you know, roller hockey has changed the life for so many people. Has having this book, having there is a landing spot for some of that, some of those issues. And I think the PS to that is that in real life, that ended up being part of the turning point before your parents split. So that was a really pivotal time. Having a place to put those things, has that been, I don't want to fill in the word, Tommy. You fill in what it's been.
I mean, I think once I discovered that art, and specifically the novel, was a place you could potentially put everything, is when I became convinced that I wanted to make one. I mean, I think art serves a lot of functions, both personal and communal. And I think at some point I just got convinced that the novel could really hold a lot of weight and vision and memory that I knew I would like to somehow talk about. And when I read a lot of what authors do, whenever I read somebody doing something kind of outside of what is expected or what seems possible in fiction, it gave me hope, and I kept building that over the years. Because between 2004 and 14, before I got in my MFA, I was very quietly working away at becoming a writer and not telling people. Sort of shameful if somebody says, if you say you're a writer and then you're like, you haven't done anything, there's always that sort of at least if you don't do it physically, you feel like you're going like this. If you have no like publication or way to qualify, well, what does that mean? So often I just sort of did it in private and just worked away at it. And
that experience is gone now forever for you. You know that.
Having the background of an athlete and then musician, I feel like I brought a certain kind of discipline that, like, there's an of course-ness with athletes. Like, put in the hours. Like, we can see it change your body. It seems so obvious. Musicians, sometimes obvious, sometimes not. Like a concert pianist, like, you know how many hours they put in. You can hear it in the intricacy of the way that the fingers run across, the nimbleness with the fingers running across the keyboard. You know that's practice. With writers, it feels like very, you know, like inspiration and muse-based, and like some people have, some people don't. And I just like was like, this is just like any other art form. You put in the hours and the discipline and you dig into the craft, and that should work. And I don't know if that's true, but that's what I took to it somewhat naively, because I was like, I love this in the same way that I loved roller hockey and I loved playing the piano. I took the same love and devotion of time and discipline to it.
Where is your favorite place to write?
Hotel rooms.
Because you can screen out everybody else, is that it?
I live in hotel rooms now. Like, I'm not home very much because I just have a busy schedule. And but before that, I did some amount of traveling I worked as a digital storytelling facilitator for a nonprofit out of Berkeley, working with marginalized groups to tell their story, help them tell their stories and turn them into like 3-minute videos. And I realized then that I loved it. So when I had deadlines, once I did sell a book, I would hole up in a hotel for like 4 days. And I also read out loud as part of my editing and revision process, especially toward the end. I really need to be able to read it out loud and feel good about it, not be embarrassed and hate myself. This is like my gauge before it goes out. I need to be able to read it out loud and not hate it, before I'm going to send it to somebody in a serious way. And so in hotel rooms, there's nobody listening. If I'm home, I'm always afraid that somebody could be listening. Even if they're just hearing like the tones through the walls, it's more than I want anybody to hear.
Wow.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out.
Author Tommy Orange, discussing his book, There, There, with Insight's Beth Ruyak. Our podcast is produced by Jen Picard. Recording engineers are Mark Jones and Antonio Munoz. Director of On Demand is Sally Schilling. The executive producer is Joe Barr. Our theme song is from Pond 5. You can find more information about the authors and books online, capradio.org/reads. Keep up with our latest conversations by subscribing to Cap Radio Reads on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. While you're at it, check out our other podcasts. Find them at capradio.org/podcasts. I'm Donna Epidoni. Thanks for listening to Cap Radio Reads from Cap Radio.